Meeting. We are meeting in person and via Zoom, and this meeting is being webcast and recorded. For those who have completed a virtual speaker card for our Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera turned off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting or exit the meeting at that time. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is also available. Now I'd like to ask our board members, my colleagues, to please introduce themselves, and I'll go to the end with Board Member Al Lopez.
Right here? Yes. Okay. Good morning. My name is Al Lopez. I'm the immediate board member, Western Municipal Water District, and also a former mayor and councilman, City of Corona.
Good morning, everyone. Gloria Alvarado, resident of the City of Santa Ana, and I would like to thank the City of Orange for hosting us today.
Board Member Letitia Clark. And good morning, Board Member William Rue. Bill, was your mic on? Bill, was your mic on? They're asking it.
So can you hear this? Press not.
This button. Right?
Okay, can you hear me?
There you go.
I'm Bill Rue, a resident of the City of Montclair, where I've lived my entire life. I'm also a council member in the City of Montclair, so welcome.
And Vice Chair John Scandura.
Good morning, everybody. I'm John Scandura. I've been a Huntington Beach resident for 30 years. I was also born and raised in the Inland Empire. Welcome to all those who are here physically present, as well as those who are viewing on Zoom.
Well, we have a lot of California natives with us on this board. I was also born and raised across Southern California, a resident of Anaheim, former Mayor Pro Tem and Councilwoman of our City of Anaheim. Thank you to Orange for hosting us. I'd also like to take a moment to just acknowledge that tonight is the opening of the Olympic Games, where our world comes together to peacefully assemble and compete. I am a huge Olympics fan every 4 years, so I'm really looking forward to it. I just wanted to take a moment to wish our athletes from California and the United States to send our best wishes to them. May they have success in their competitions. And also to acknowledge that Orange County will be home to some of the Olympic Games, as well as other parts of our region in Southern California, where we'll be hosting LA 28. In the next round of Olympic Games. So wishing everyone, all the teams around the world competing, that you have a safe and wonderful competition, and go Team USA. With that, I'd just like to thank everyone for joining us as chair. It's my great honor to be a representative of this agency. Now I'd like to open item 2, our public forum. We welcome hearing from the public at this meeting. Any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker request. For those items listed on today's agenda, you will make your comments at the time the item is being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments will be limited to 3 minutes. Jessica, do we have any speaker cards?
Madam Chair, there are no speakers.
Okay, thank you. So we'll move on to item 3, and I'd like to introduce our State Water Resources Control Board member, Dee Dee Diamo, who will provide an update on the State Water Resources Control Board. Dee Dee, are you with us online?
Good morning.
There she is. Good morning. Welcome.
Good to see you all. Well, I'll start off with updating you all on our recently adopted rulemaking, making conservation a way of life. I've updated you all many times throughout the years regarding this really complicated rulemaking on outdoor water use, but I am just really honored to be part of a process that worked through many of the challenges that we had with this regulation. So it does come into effect right now. The rule, we adopted it in July, and it is currently at the Office of Administrative Law for final review and adoption. We do expect that it will become final by the end of the year, and the effective date is January 2025. But there is additional timeframes. There are additional timeframes provided depending upon whether or not communities have variances, or if they're at a certain level of median household income. So I would really encourage water suppliers that haven't been engaged in this process to get up to speed so that they understand the various compliance deadlines. I know our state board adopted a climate change resolution several years back, and the regional boards one by one have followed suit. And we think that it's time to take a look at the climate change resolution that we've adopted and see what we can do to incorporate some of the most recent findings regarding climate change. For example, we weren't aware of even the concept of aridification and the intensity of these high heat events and the impact of loss of snowpack. Back when we adopted it, we were aware of it, but not to the level that we are now. And so it's important to update the science, update the information that we have upon which to make our decisions. And what we've decided to do with this is really take some time over the next year to have a more robust stakeholder process. We'll be working with all of our divisions and offices, regional boards, and a full-blown stakeholder process. We're also going to be bringing in, we're hoping to get some good input from the Air Resources Board on the energy piece, and then, of course, our sister agency at the Department of Water Resources. There's been a lot of activity on safe drinking water, and in particular, just a day before yesterday, we had an event that Secretary Garcia attended, as well as our Chair Esquivel, looking at the marker of this midway point for the safe and affordable funding for equity and resilience. This is a 10-year program that we received funding for, and I am just really honored in every way to have been part of this process. This getting safe and affordable drinking water to all of Californians really is one of our board's top priorities. And so 5 years into the plan, we know we still have a long way to go, but we have been able to reduce the number of people in California that don't have access to safe drinking water from 1.6 million to 700,000. And so big strides have been made in this five-year period, but obviously we have a long way to go. And most likely the next milestones are going to be very challenging to meet. Fair to say that we picked a lot of the low-hanging fruit early on, and that as we see moving forward, it continues. We continue to see a lot of challenges, but this fund has really helped us to close the gap on some projects that wouldn't otherwise quite meet the state revolving funds that we have available. Also, it has allowed us to engage in technical assistance, appointment of an administrator, and really encourage communities to look at options that they have that would be in the best interest of the community. And so we're really excited that we've seen 142 consolidations through this process, benefiting over 100,000 people since 2019. And as far as distribution of funds, $830 million in grants, more than two times the amount in the previous 5 years. Switching to a process that we do every year, this time regarding the state revolving fund for drinking water, we had a workshop on July 16th for the intended use plan. for this year's plan, and then also the fund expenditure plan specifically targeted at the topic that I just talked about, the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund for Equity and Resilience, you know, the additional fund that we have. And so really aligning adoption of both with a July 16th board workshop, July 24th yesterday, deadline for public comment. And then we expect that we'll be adopting both plans on August 20th. Good news on Chrome 6. I know I've reported on this before that we did adopt the Chrome 6 maximum contaminant level, but the regulation had been over at the Office of Administrative Law for final approval. And I'm really pleased to announce that the Office of Administrative Law just recently approved the regulation. And it is enforceable as of October 1. And for any that want to learn more about it, please go to our website for Chrome 6 maximum contaminant level. Switching to the wastewater side of the house, Clean Water State Revolving Fund. We also are going to be considering the intended use plan, which is something that we do annually. We had a board workshop on July 2nd. Comments were due July 15th. And I do expect that we will be considering that for adoption at our August 6th meeting, our next meeting. We have a project that's underway, really learning a lot on the safe drinking water piece. In order to move forward with that project, we really needed first, you know, out of the gate to just grapple with what's the extent of the problem? What, you know, what are the needs, safe drinking water needs for Californians? And that process we are replicating on the wastewater side. So we have kicked off a four-year project. It's well underway. And the purpose here is to determine the wastewater needs of California and the gap that we have in meeting the need. We did adopt a resolution providing that access to sanitation is a basic human right and safe wastewater is critical to public health. And so what we're doing now is we have a 30-member advisory committee and board member Morgan, my colleague, who is her expertise is in the wastewater field. She's an engineer, and she is kicking off the first meeting that we have today with this advisory committee that will be advising us on the factors that we should be looking at as part of this really important need assessment. Well, with wildfire season underway here, and all of us are very much aware and concerned, I know, about wildfires, we can play an important role in preparedness and mitigation for wildfires. And our staff did just release on June 28th a draft general order and related environmental documents on an expedited authorization process for the utility wildfire general order. This expedited process is for electric utilities that conduct wildfire mitigation, electric operations, and maintenance activities that support safety needs while at the same time ensuring adequate water quality protections are in place. We have a staff workshop on July 23rd, just earlier this week, a public hearing on August 20th, and written comments are due on August 30th. And I just really want to thank your executive officer and others from the regional boards that helped our staff to put together this draft order. And then the last thing I have is just a quick update on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. We are well underway with processing consideration for probationary status for six basins that were sent to us from the Department of Water Resources for not meeting the standard set out under this important statute and guidance and regulation from the Department of Water Resources. We did place the Tulare Lake Basin on probation The next probationary hearing that we have is the Thule sub-basin. And then just yesterday, our staff issued a notice for a probationary hearing for the Kern sub-basin. And that notice that just went out for the hearing is posted on February 20th. And the idea here in providing for some additional time before we actually go to hearing is to place all of the pumpers on notice and to give them an opportunity to read through the staff report and to understand the bases by which our staff is recommending probationary status, and to give them time to provide for written and verbal response, but also to submit an updated plan that would meet the mark so that we might be able to consider that prior to going to hearing in February. And so I would say so far, the process, I believe, is, you know, because of that additional time that we're providing these sub-basins, it also allows us as board members to get out to the community, conduct tours, and have workshops. And so I would say, even though this is quite challenging for the communities that are facing potential probationary status, the process so far is going well. It's an open, transparent process. And that's all I have. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate how thorough your updates are. Thank you for that. I'd like to ask if any of the board members, my colleagues, have any questions for Dee Dee. I don't see any. So Dee Dee, we'll just wish you a wonderful weekend and thank you again for your service and your report.
Thank you. Good to see you all.
Thank you. We're now at item 4, and I'd like to introduce Jane Joy, our Executive Director, who will provide an update on the Racial Equity Act activities of our agency.
Can you hear me? Is it working? Well, good morning. Jane Joy, Executive Officer. Good morning, Chair Murray and board members. I'm really pleased to present to you the progress that we've made on the development of our Racial Equity Action Plan. Next slide, please. And I'm just going to walk you through what this plan is. The plan is something that I approve, and it's going to be posted to our website as soon as it's 100%. It does not require board approval, but your input is invaluable. So I'm listening, and we're all listening. But today I want to walk through the content of the action plan, what's included in it, talk about the strategic objectives and the supporting goals and tasks that we've started or plan to start, and then how we're going to monitor and report. And the plan itself is called, we're going to call it a living document, or a document that's easily updatable. Again, as I've said many times, we're learning. We're growing and we're understanding how to incorporate racial equity and address environmental injustice within our programs. And as we learn, we're going to adjust our practices so that we're successful. And so for sure, we will be reviewing this plan every 5 years, but most likely we'll be amending it as we go. Next slide. So these are the 4 strategic objectives. They're right out of the resolution. These are the ones that we agreed to that we would support, and they do kind of feed on each other. We start with integration and learning what we're doing, and then integrating into our system, working with our community, and moving forward. And I'll go through each one of these and explain our plan. Next slide. So under each of these strategic objectives, there's goals that are written. For strategic objective 1, we have 2 goals. We're looking at data accessibility, and we're also looking at how to adjust our programs and our policy and realign with making sure that we're treating everyone fair and equitable. Looking at the items that are in the box, those are our tasks. And the tasks include, for data accessibility, I've listed the racial equity teamwork. We have an internal group that's designed with all levels of of management and staff over many sections, and we get together every couple of weeks and develop and talk about how to execute the racial equity resolution. And so this team is responsible for development of this action plan. They are very energetic. We have good conversations, and we're moving forward. As the lead for the office, I have seen a true change in behavior throughout the organization, and I marry that up with our team efforts and how they have been able to reach out. The other items we look at is we're going to develop a toolkit. We have a lot of resources available to us through state, through EPA, through OEHA. There's databases that we can use to identify where our low-income areas are and marry that up with our water quality programs and how do they interface and are there areas that we need to improve on. We're also going to incorporate as a criteria into our integrated report. And the integrated report is basically a list of impaired water bodies throughout our region. The State Board approves those listings, but we as the region set the priority. And one of those priorities we're going to include in the next round, which is 2026, is the development of or incorporation of location or proximity to disadvantaged community and tribal activities. For programs and policies, we're improving our public outreach. We're connecting with others. Just a couple of examples is we have a couple projects that are really kind of well designed for this type of work, and it's basically conversion of septic systems to sewer. Two major projects that are occurring within our region. One is in Arrowhead Farms, and we're working with Maria Kennedy, somebody that Al has introduced me to. And Maria is also an advisor on the wastewater assessment that Dee Dee was talking about as well. So we have a voice within that program too, so I'm excited about that. And then also we're working with the city of Fontana. They have several septic systems that we would like to see sewered. The reason I think that it would be helpful to bring these to convert these systems is that a lot of the issues related to our communities is housing, right, and growth. And so a lot of, several of the septic systems, especially in Fontana, seems to be one of the areas where we have had to deny expansion of their garages into an alternative dwelling unit because their septic systems just aren't large enough and their property's too small. If it was sewered, this would not be a problem. And so we were really looking forward to see this happen. Septic systems are a large source of nitrates and TDS to our groundwater basins as well. So it's a win-win, I think, for everybody if we can see those happening. And for Fontana, we're understanding that they have actually received funding for the planning stages. So these are multi-year projects, but we will continue to do what we can do to help support that work. In other areas, we've got stalled cases. These are related to our underground storage tank cleanup sites and restoration sites. There's hundreds of them in our region. And so we want to go back and look at some of those cases that have been stalled and try to identify, one, the reason why, where they're located. A lot of times they're stalled because the owner has changed or they don't have the finances to support the effort. And so we're going to revisit those priorities. And see if we can maybe assist some of those projects moving forward. And again, we're going to continue discussions. Board Member Diadamo brought up climate change. We're going to put more energy to it, is the development of a climate change resolution. We do see a nexus between that and determining whether or not these effects from climate change, the urbanization that she talked about, the hot spots, even flooding, are disadvantaged communities or low-income areas being impacted more than others. We need to do that assessment. So we will bring a resolution to you for approval. It's still very, very draft, so it'll be a while, but we are looking into that. and then also a tribal engagement plan. We're going to be working on that as well. Next slide. This strategic objective is looking at spaces of inclusion and belonging. So it works in both areas. It works internally with our workforce and also with how we work with our communities. It's trying to lower that, for the external, lower that government boundary where we don't want to be the government arm that causes problems. We want to be somebody that's listening. And so we are trying to change that. And I think that's going to be a challenge, but we will do our best. Internally, we're looking at reflecting diversity. All those that are listed in that item, the panel requirements, recruitment, we have initiated most of those. I think we're still updating our website, but our hiring practice has changed. We talk about racial equity in our interviews. We put it into our duty statements. We're moving forward and looking forward to seeing that help to make sure that our workforce is diverse. And then B is a little bit more on the external side and how we communicate with our dischargers and our communities. So one thing I wanted to make sure that you all understood is there's number two is a roundtable discussions. You might not know what a roundtable is, but a roundtable for us, they're led by the state board typically, but they're statewide, includes regional boards and departments up at state board level to talk about specific programs. There's about 15 or 20 of them. I didn't count them, but there's a lot, and they're by program. So there'll be a wastewater roundtable. There'll be a TMDL roundtable, and our staff is involved in all of those. In each one of those discussions, we have an opportunity to hear what's happening with other regions. We have an opportunity to share what we're doing. And it also, within each roundtable discussion on the agenda, is the discussion of racial equity and happening so that the communication chain is pretty good. And we do learn from each other. So I wanted to highlight that because that has been a good resource for us. And then for 2B, I also wanted to highlight, we have a couple of programs, the Nonpoint Source Program and the Irrigated Lands Program. These programs are generally in our lower income area. Public outreach has already started, and we've been doing it all along. But we have a couple of programs that that we are really focusing on inclusion. One of the things that we are going to do with our inspectors, when they go out in the field, we're going to make sure that they have implicit bias training. So when they go out, they can maybe understand where they could create a barrier just by the words that they say, to be a little bit more sensitive to that. Next slide. So as I said, these things kind of build in each other. So strategic objective one is kind of we're trying to meet our community in with a different view and lens on how we approach them. Three is where we want to identify partners and those that we've been able to communicate with on multiple levels, on multiple projects, and kind of get a feel so that we kind of have a partner in the field and per se. We're not there yet, but I do have several that I've identified that we will begin to develop those relationships and see where they take us. And so this is engaging with our communities. We're also looking at including a tribal beneficial use within our basin plan. And what that means is that within the basin plan, we've identified multiple beneficial uses. It could be the water's used for municipal or drinking water, the water used for recreation, or the water supports some kind of biological activity. And there's several different categories there. But we also want to include tribal beneficial uses. And these include things like support for ceremonies that take place in a water body or on a river's edge, or if the tribes use that river for substance or consumption. They fish or they use it for that reason. And so these beneficial uses, what they do is, if they're in our basin plan, we can designate the water bodies. Once we learn from our tribes which water bodies they use most of all or are concerned with, we can apply these beneficial uses to that water body, which gives us the ability to set water quality objectives for that purpose. So, for example, if a tribe is going to use, say, a lake, and part of their ceremony is to actually physically be in the lake, whether you know, it's somehow they're physically in the lake, that tribal beneficial use will make sure that that water body will sustain and protect the human entering the water. You know, the ceremony is one thing, but the water quality is what we do, right? So that it will be used. You know, or if they're fishing, that we don't have toxins in the water that could produce fish that cause health issues. So that's coming, and we're going to be working on that. I'm hoping to get those in 2025. Let's see. And then the second part, 3B, is really looking at removing barriers. You see climate change in and throughout here. And again, that's an assumption that climate change is going to have an impact. Once it's identified what those impacts are, we'll know more. But we don't want to forget it. We do feel that there's probably going to be a nexus there. And so we put it in several places just to keep it on our radar. Also, the barriers are funding. And you heard from Board Member D'Adamo the funding resources that have been provided. And they've been pretty significant. And I believe they're going to continue. And we will continue to see what we can do to support to get funding into some of our areas. An example, I do know that SAPA has received a grant funding to look into climate change. And it does include an element of evaluation of how it relates to our low-income areas. And we're going to be assisting, or we'll be following and assisting where we can on that grant proposal. And then, of course, we'll translate any materials that we have into the appropriate language based on the need. And the next slide. So this is the last one. Really, all this one is just a commitment that we will continue what we started, and we're not going to stop. I heard this very clearly from several of you that this isn't a check the box. This is a cultural change. And I'm really pleased. I've learned so much, and I am so pleased with where we're headed. I do think it's healthy. I think it's supporting communities. I think we've got a lot of good things for us. So really, what this is a commitment to keep going. There are a couple programs that are relatively mature that I've included on the list up here, and that's our cannabis program and our confined animal should be feeding operations. They call them CAFOs. Spelling error. But these two programs, they already permit or enforce in areas where there's low-income housing or homeless populations. And so these programs have the experience of working with low-income areas. And so we'll continue those. We'll as we learn, we're going to grow. But these programs already kind of have an inherent element of working in disadvantaged communities. And that's next slide. That's all I have. Very interested in input, and you can call me. We can talk now. Once the plan is complete, I will post it on the website. I will get you all a copy. Again, it's going to be something that we can amend relatively easy. We're going to have a web page for racial equity. We have one right now, but it just refers up to the state board. But because we now have substance, we have a resolution, we'll have an action plan, we're going to have region-specific items to include on that page, and we're moving forward with that as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jane. I'm going to open it up to the board to start. Do we have any questions? Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, real quick, Director Alvarado.
The question I have, we're doing a lot of outreach, and this is positive. How are we being received by the various different entities? With skepticism or with openness or, hey, this is wonderful?
From my view, and is so far we've had, Claudia's here, her program has had several discussions with a lot of the tribes on the fill and dredge projects. Fill and dredge projects touch land that hasn't been touched before, so it's a new development, and so we're finding that the tribes are very interested in some of those projects. She and her team has done an excellent job of making sure that we listen to them and we talk to them. So I feel like it's been a good, it's been good so far. It's just not mature enough. I haven't experienced anything negative. I have, if that helps. And the people that I've talked to related to, say, Maria Kennedy, we're going to have a standing conversation. And with SAPA, I'll be meeting with them regularly. I did meet with a group called Studio MLA. I took our team up there. They were doing projects along the LA River that were related to it's kind of a holistic approach to creating the river banks so that they protect the wetlands that are produced. They create parks that are free for the communities to use. They have this really outstanding public outreach process to identify what the needs are. And they're actually working on two projects in our region. One's in Anaheim for the 28 Olympics, and the other one is in Riverside. And I was just very impressed with this group on how they did their outreach. It was unique. They went to the public, and so I'm going to stay in connection with them as well, see what we can do to help on those, specifically those projects that are within the city of Riverside and the city of Anaheim. So far, no negatives, but I don't know if a non-response is a negative response, so too. I'm a little sensitive to that.
Board Member Alvarado, and then Board Member Clark, and then Board Member Lopez. That's the order I've seen you all raise your hands. Thank you.
First of all, thank you so much for the report. I think the outreach and engagement, as you just mentioned, if there's projects going on, it will be great maybe to list them so that perhaps in the future we might be able to engage and actually participate in those, yes, especially if we have one or two that are already in a region. And the other, I think when we look at needs assessment, it will be really good to maybe plan like a tour of our areas. Sure. And that way we can engage at that level as well, go into the communities perhaps and just visit. We know some of the problem areas already. And if we don't, perhaps look at, you know, those difficult areas as you were just describing, some of the changes, some of the issues that we're facing when you mentioned housing, right? If they mm-hmm. want to expand, maybe we don't have the right sewer systems in place, but perhaps if we engage in them, the residents in the community can also engage in perhaps asking for funding directly, not only through their cities, but maybe through their counties. And perhaps we can find some local grants that perhaps are not that big, mm-hmm. but could help in funding Sorry. Those projects. So thank you so much for all the work. I think we're going in the right path, and I am excited to see this document come to life. Like you said, it's a live, a living document, and I am very happy with all the process. Thank you.
Board Member Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to reiterate my congratulations to you for moving forward on this item, being so thorough on this subject matter. I think I've mentioned before that, you know, we saw a trend in doing, you know, DEI equity, racial equity work in the aftermath of George Floyd, and we're starting to see that trend decline. And so I want to commend you for just keeping the passion alive for this work, because you, I think, have articulated so well the importance of it and our involvement with it. So I just wanted to start there. I had a question in particular about strategic objective number 4 that says sharing power and knowledge with communities. Do we define power in a certain way? I'm wondering how in this body we define
Yeah, I, you know,
power.
That's a really good question. We don't really, but I do think, this is my philosophy, and I'm open to suggestions. We're a public agency, and it's our job to make sure that regulations are fair and equitable across the board. And so I think in a sustained relationship for communities that have not had a voice for a long time, I think the idea of using the word power is that we're going to listen. Where they haven't been listened to before, we need to adjust our ears to really hear what they're saying and what their concerns are. So I think that's more of the idea of power. I don't think we can say we're going to give them authority to do it all, but sure. What we can do is have the power to be able to speak to our board, to listen, and then we need to be careful on how we respond so that, you know, we don't keep those institutional structures and old mindsets working. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to change how we see the picture of things, and we got to change how we evaluate problems and avoid just the loud voices. We have to listen to the quiet voices as
yeah.
well. I think that's the idea.
I think that's great. I would equate power with influence and access, so that sounds right, yeah. that we're just, you know, providing more access to hear various voices and essentially give them a seat at the table where they haven't had one before. So I love that. I think my only follow-up is just how we spread the good news. You know, I asked about social media before, and I know we might be going in that direction. But until then, I'm wondering if there might be a press release or something that, you know, even the board can share, like on LinkedIn or something like that, so that folks know what the work is versus just kind of sharing a web page. But I think a press release could go a long way. We could quote, you know, the chair or you, Jane, and just articulating how much this means to this body and this organization, and allow us to do some promotion to help get the word out, because it's good news, but good news not shared is not news,
it's
right?
Not news,
so,
right.
Yes. But I'm just really excited about the trajectory of the progress with this resolution and the action plan. I think speaks volumes that it's not just semantics. It's, you know, work being put into place. And one more thing, I'll just say, in other arenas, I've seen a trend where the mentoring piece is really big, you know, really investing in youth to provide that access and influence. So I think that's going to be a real game changer in terms of figuring out how we connect to youth in our community and exposing them to the work of water and the importance of water. And, you know, that's, I think, how we actually achieve equity in the future. Maybe not in our service time, but for years and generations to come, to get our youth passionate and knowledgeable about the work that we're doing so that they can be in these seats in the future. I think that's key. So I love that piece, and I think we could probably lean into that a little bit more.
Yes, excellent. Yeah, I would definitely agree with all
Thank
of
you.
Those.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I think we can do a press release. It'll be good timing to do it once the action plan is posted too, because you've got a resolution and it's conceptual, but then the action plan has like real things that we're going to do and commitments that we're going to make. And so, we can definitely make that happen. And we are looking into the social media. We have used state boards a little bit, but yeah. So I've got the younger folks working on that. It's not my area, but yes.
Thank you. You hit on a lot of the points I wanted to ask about too, so thank you. Board Member Lopez.
No, my question was, is there a time frame to complete the plan in total
have
to submit to the state or something?
So the plan gets approved by me and gets posted on our website, and then we'll do a press release. I'm hoping to have it done by the end of August, if all goes well. Right now, all management and up has reviewed it. We have a few things that we still need to complete and refine. But today, I've asked all of our staff to look at the action plan and provide comment by August 15th. And so once we have all those comments, and we should be able to finalize it by the end of August, that's my goal. And I, I, I intend to meet it. I don't want to let it go too much longer than that. So,
thank you. Vice Chair Scandura. Sure.
Thank you very much, Jane. Great presentation, and obviously a lot of tremendous amount of work going on. Just a couple questions and then a comment. So you mentioned a little bit earlier you're working with the city of Fontana on their sewer, on their converting, well, their septic tank systems and also their septic to sewer conversion. Are we working with some other communities on that as well? I mean, one I'm thinking of is the one near Canyon Lake.
The one near Canyon Lake,
yeah.
Elsinore? I know that Elsinore, I'm not sure if we're talking about the same community, because we do know that there are septic systems that are located near Elsinore in the city of Elsinore Valley, and I do believe they have a program where they're evaluating it. I currently don't know the status, but I do know that they're looking into converting to sewer.
Okay. And then I also wanted to really commend the Water Board here for when we have those applications to expand houses, add dwelling units, to really stand firm if it turns out that the septic system can't handle it. I think it takes a lot of guts, especially nowadays when agencies are under a lot of pressure to approve housing. And I support more housing, but, you know, if it's going to cause pollution, I think we have to stand firm on that. So I really commend you guys for doing that. Let's see, on the last objective, I think...
Those are really difficult decisions. It's hard, but thank you.
And then I think you were mentioning about, I think under the last objective, expansion of outreach efforts and confined animal operations. So that's feeding operations. I take it that includes all the dairies or what's left of them here in our region.
There's chicken farms, there's horse ranches, and there's, you know, they're mostly in the Inland Empire. There might be a couple in Orange County, but yeah. That includes all those types of facilities.
Sure. And then last of all, I wanted to echo what Board Member Alvarado mentioned about having a tour. I think it would be great for us to actually get out into many of these communities and really see what they are. It's different when you're reading them on a piece of paper versus actually being out there. And I think I've said this before in the past, future board meetings, I don't think they necessarily have to be in, city council chambers and other board meeting rooms with dioceses and all that fancy stuff. I mean, there's a lot of communities out there that that we should be considering having our meetings at, even if it's at a community center, if it's in a disadvantaged community or vulnerable community, have it in one of their community centers, even if it's with a folding table and microphones. That way, I think it really shows that, you know, we're putting our money, our money where our mouth is, so to speak, really getting out there and engaging with them. So it's something to consider next year when we schedule our future board meetings.
Absolutely. Good suggestion.
Thank you. I do want to agree with that, and I saw everyone nodding their head. I know we've had meetings out at Quail Valley before and in other parts of the region, and I think we do need to make sure that we're accessible physically to all of our communities. So I also support rotating our meetings around. I know that adds a lot of time and potentially some resource demands for staff, but when we can do that, I think it would be very valuable to do that throughout the year. The other is, and I'll use Quail Valley as an example again, a lot of the projects, as we really dig in and hear from folks, we're going to hear also that there are funding disparities that are pretty significant. And so where we can team up with local agencies or cities or community organizations or tribal organizations to seek federal earmarks where the larger dollars are going to come from for infrastructure, I'd like to do that. I know we did that with Quail Valley and had some success there. But that's one area where we can lend our voices to advocate for those critical dollars that will truly transform communities long term. And then I'd just like to acknowledge and thank the staff who've been engaged in working with you. I know a lot of them volunteered and really have put so much of their personal passion and time into this. And to make this a dynamic and organic and grassroots effort. And so just please let them know. I think some of them are here with us today. I know some of them are, but some may not be here. So if you could just please, on behalf of the board, let them know how much we value and we know the community's value. And I think, you know, we may be hearing or lack of feedback at this point. I think we have to build trust.
Mm-hmm. And so just not hearing back could be a reticence to, you know, is this real? Is it sustainable? Am I just being courted at this point? Or again, like I think Director Clark said, is this semantics or is this real? And so I think as the time goes on and we show that we'll be nimble, we will build in feedback as we get it. We will also look for those longer-term constructive outcomes that really move the needle. That's when we'll start building that echo chamber of interest and support and engagement. So, again, this is a long game. This is the beginning of that. But we need to, again, build that trust. And I know we will. But I'm thrilled that we're all here at the beginning of this because it's an important paradigm shift.
I really appreciate your support.
Board Member Rue.
Yes, many of you, or probably most of you, were not here when we were dealing with a situation in both Rialto with perchlorate and with the issue in Quail Valley. In Rialto, we had some evening meetings and we had one or two weekend meetings so the public could attend. In Quail Valley, I don't recall a weekend meeting, but I do recall several evening meetings which enabled the public to get there. So those are things we have done in the past, and when the moment arises, we could do again in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, agreed.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you
so much. All right, while Jane comes back up and joins us on the dais, I'll move on to item 5, which is approval of our meeting minutes for the May 3rd board meeting. On page 2, there is a word change in the first bullet under the sustainable groundwater management of designation to probation. The bullet now reads, on April 5th, the State Water Board held a virtual workshop on the proposed probation of for the Tulare sub-basin. I'd request a motion and a second.
I will make a motion for the minutes as presented this morning with the corrections.
Second, Madam Chair.
So moved and seconded. Jessica, would you please call the roll?
Board Member Lopez?
Aye.
Board Member Alvarado?
Aye.
Board Member Clark?
Yes.
Board Member Rue?
Aye.
Vice Chair Scandura?
Yes.
And Chair Murray?
Aye. Excuse me, Madam Chair, my understanding was Board Member Rue was going to abstain on this item. Were you here at that meeting?
This is the meeting that you were
going to. Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay. I can motion to approve the minutes.
And do you want a second? Or I'll say it. Yeah, okay.
Second.
All right. Do we need to recall it or are we fine?
Yeah, you can just go ahead and vote again.
Okay. Jessica, please call the roll.
Board Member Lopez?
Aye.
Board Member Alvarado?
Aye.
Board Member Clark?
Aye.
Board Member Rue?
I have to abstain.
Vice Chair Scandura?
Yes.
And Chair Murray?
Yes, thank you. Now we'll move on to item 6, is the consideration of the consent calendar, listed as items 7, 8, 9, and 10. Item 7 does have an errata sheet, and items 9 and 10 have similar typographical errors in the discharge prohibition section, number 2, where the first words to be changed from expect to accept. At this time, I want to ask if there are any interested persons or board member requests to remove any of the consent items. Do we have any? Seeing none, Jessica, are there any speaker cards for items 7 through 10?
No, there's not.
Okay, do we have any board member comments? Seeing none, Jessica, please call the roll.
You need the motion and the second?
I'll make a motion.
My apologies. Yeah, motion and a second.
We'll see. That would be a motion.
On item 7 through 10.
For the consent calendar, items as presented.
With the corrections and the errata.
There we go. That's what I was looking for.
I'll second.
Okay, great. We have a motion and a second. And Jessica, would you please call for the roll?
Board Member Lopez?
Aye.
Board Member Alvarado?
Aye.
Board Member Clark?
Aye.
Board Member Rue?
Aye.
Vice Chair Scandura?
Aye.
Chair Murray?
Aye. And that item passes. We'll move on to item 11. Claudia Tenorio, our Senior Environmental Scientist, will provide an overview of the triennial review process. Excuse me. A public hearing for the Santa Ana Water Board meeting to consider adoption of the triennial review will be held, forgive me, later this year. And Claudia, if you'd like to, well, welcome. Thank you for your presentation.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Good morning, Chair Murray and members of the board. My name is Claudia Tenorio. I'm a senior environmental scientist, and I'm the supervisor of the Regional Planning Program section. My section oversees basin planning activities as well as stretch and fill projects. Today, I will be providing an overview of the triennial review and providing a status update of our current triennial review process for the years 2024 through 2027. Alrighty, so this is an outline of what I'm going to be discussing today. First, starting with some background on the basin plan. Next, the triennial review federal and state requirements, the purpose, scope, and selection of priority projects, and then end with next steps. So I would like to start with some background on the basin plan. The basin plan is a master water quality control planning document. It's a document that's designed to protect the water quality of the Santa Ana region's ground and surface waters. The basin plan prescribes beneficial uses, water quality objectives, and also includes implementation strategies and timelines. A little bit more background on the basin plan. As I mentioned, the basin plan prescribes or designates beneficial uses. And a beneficial use is one of the various ways that water can be used for the benefit of people and or wildlife. And examples, and I know Jane touched on this a little bit earlier, but examples of beneficial uses include drinking, swimming, agriculture, uses that support fresh or saline aquatic habitats, and water can have multiple beneficial uses. The basin plan also contains water quality objectives, and those objectives can be narrative or numeric. And in general, a water quality objective is the limits or levels of water quality established for the protection of beneficial uses. And the principal means that we have for achieving water quality objectives and protecting beneficial uses is through the issuance of National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits, or NPDES permits, like our stormwater permits or the MS4. We also have waste discharge requirements, like the ones you just adopted earlier. We have water quality certifications and waste discharge prohibitions. Alrighty, and so this is a figure of our region, which covers portions of San Bernardino County, Riverside County, and Orange County. And some of the major water bodies in our region, obviously, is the Santa Ana River. We also have Lake Elsinore, the Prado Dam area, and Newport Bay, just to name a few. Alrighty. Oops, sorry, I think I skipped a slide. There we go. Trying to review federal and state requirements. The Federal Clean Water Act requires that water quality standards be reviewed every 3 years, and that's where we have this term triennial review. And under the Federal Clean Water Act, water quality standards include both designated beneficial uses as well as water quality criteria. US EPA regulations also require that the review of water quality standards include public participation. Additionally, we also have the Port of Cologne Water Quality Control Act that requires a periodic review of water quality control plans. And I didn't include a bullet point in the presentation, but I do want to mention that the last time that the board adopted a triennial review was in June of 2019. And due to staffing constraints and resource constraints, we are delayed in meeting that three-year deadline required under the Federal Clean Water Act. So now that I've talked about the legal requirements, what is the purpose of having a triennial review? The review of water quality standards and the basin plan ensure that standards are based on the current science, methodologies, and guidance. The review assists staff in identifying necessary updates or revisions to the basin plan to update outdated information. Updates and revisions to the basin plan may be necessary due to changes in laws or regulation, updated water quality criteria, or physical changes in the region. The triennial review assists staff in identifying potential basin planning issues that can then be addressed through subsequent basin plan amendment projects. And these basin plan amendment projects that are identified as part of the triennial review process, they're put onto a list that we refer to as the triennial review priority list. So we go through this review process, we identify the projects, and then we put them on a priority list. Alrighty. So continuing on with the process. The process for the Santa Ana region for the triennial review includes three phases. Phase one is internal review of water quality standards and the preliminary identification of potential basin plan amendment projects. This phase includes reaching out to each section in our region and soliciting input on potential basin plan amendments. Then we have phase two, which includes public meetings and solicitation of input from interested persons and tribes on potential basin plan amendments and how to prioritize those issues that have been identified. So this phase allows interested parties and the public to provide input on what should be considered a priority for the region. And then we also have phase three, which is Santa Ana Water Board adoption of the Triennial Review Priority List and the establishment of a three-year work plan. So the adoption of the work plan will direct basin planning efforts for a three-year period. This slide includes major milestones of the Triennial Review process. On January 31st, staff held a scoping meeting where we announced the kickoff of our phase two approach, where we presented a preliminary list of issues to be included on a priority list. This was a hybrid meeting that was held at SAPA, and we had close to 100 participants. On March 29th, we issued a notice of solicitation of public comment, and solicitation noted was in a draft priority list list and work plan. The solicitation notice was distributed to hundreds of parties through the government delivery list, as well as tribes on the Native American Heritage Commission. The solicitation period ended on April 29th, and we received three comment letters. And we are currently working in our response to comments document to respond to those documents and making updates to the proposed priority list and work plan based on those comments that we received. In addition, we're also preparing a staff report and a resolution that we plan to release with our final proposed priority list on August 15th as part of our 45-day notice of public hearing. And then the public comment period for that, it will end on September 30th. This will give the public another opportunity to provide comments on our final proposed list prior to board adoption on October 25th. And then as part of the board adoption hearing, the public will have an opportunity to provide oral comments on that final proposed list prior to adoption. Alrighty, so I've talked about the legal requirements, the process, and I'll touch on priority criteria. Staff have developed a criteria on what to consider when determining if a project or an issue should be considered a priority and how those projects should be ranked, so ranking one project versus another. So factors that staff take into account are projects for the protection and restoration of beneficial uses, projects that aligned with our board's priorities or priorities of the State Water Board or USEPA, availability of necessary expertise and funding or other resources. And what we mean by this, there may be funding that's available for a specific project, and that funding needs to be used within a specific time frame, maybe in the fiscal year or a calendar year. If not, that funding will be lost. So we will take that into consideration when determining if a project is a priority. And an example of such projects is the shellfish study. Also, do we have ongoing projects with allocated resources, projects that would improve clarity and consistency in the basin plan, and lastly, projects that can realistically be completed during, or reasonably be completed during the Triennial Review period. Okay, so the next two slides include screenshots of staff's proposed Triennial Review work plan and project ranking. I want to make it clear that this is not our final proposed list, and we will be releasing the final list on August 15th, and there may be some minor changes to what you see on the screen based on any additional comments that we receive. Also, I want to add that we've prepared a secondary list of issues that we're referring to as a medium priority list. So these are projects that have been identified as part of our review process, but did not elevate to the level of a high priority based on the criteria that we have developed and that I talked about earlier. And we will work, our plan is to work on those medium priority list projects as resources allow and as we work through our high priority projects. Currently, we've identified 11 Triennial Review projects. This slide here shows projects 1 through 6. And the work plan reflects the project ranking, the project name, the estimated completion date for that project, which includes approval from USEPA and the Office of Administrative Law, the estimated resources to complete that project in personnel years or PYs, and also identifying any stakeholder assistance and program leads to undertake that project. The work plan, I mentioned, reflects staff's best resource estimates for the resources needed to complete a project. However, although we're confident that we can meet the completion dates in the work plan, schedules may change based on the complexity of the issue or staffing or resources constraints once that project is undertaken. And for the purposes of this presentation, so since it's only intended to be a general overview of the trainer review and a status update, I'm not going to go into details on each of the projects that we've identified so far, because we will be covering that in detail as part of the board adoption hearing on October 25th. But one project that I do want to highlight, only because it is our highest ranked project, is the completion of the copper total maximum daily loads for Newport Bay. This board adopted the copper TMDLs in December of 2022, and staff are currently in the process of going through the state board approval process, which is tentatively scheduled for the October 2024 board meeting. So once that approval process occurs, staff will prepare the administrative record for transmittal to the US EPA in the Office of Administrative Law for approval. And one of the reasons I'm mentioning this is to point out that after regional board approval, there are still several steps that staff have to take before a basin plan amendment can become effective. And then, as I mentioned earlier, this slide shows projects 1 through 6. And then in the next slide, we have projects 7 through 11. Okay. So next steps. As I mentioned, we plan to release our final proposed list on October 15th, with the comment period ending on September 30th. Then present the Trainer review priority list and work plan at the October 25th board meeting, and then transmit the priority list and work plan to US EPA for review. And here we have contact information. Again, my name is Claudia Tenorio. If there's any questions, if any members of the public have any questions, they can reach out to me. There's my email address. They can also reach out to Kyle Fructuoso from my staff that is assisting with the review process. And then with that, we can open it up to questions.
Thank you so much. We greatly appreciate all of your expertise and this very thorough report. I'd like to open it up for board member comments. Do we have any questions at this time? I'm not seeing any, Vice Chair.
Sure, just one quick question. Mm-hmm. Of course, my comment is a great presentation and looking forward to taking up this item. I think it's in our October meeting,
yes.
Right? Okay. And then this is just a quick clarifying question. You had your slide with the triennial review process, phase 1, 2, and 3. And so phase 1 is the water quality standards and potential projects. So I take it that the list of priority projects corresponds to phase 1 then, right?
Yeah, so phase 1 is staff doing an internal review. Mm-hmm. We look at the basin plan. We reach out to the different sections that are implementing the basin plans through their permits, WDRs, NPDS. So we reach out to each individual section, supervisors, and we ask, is there any issues that you're having implementing the basin plan or these water quality standards or objectives? And so we start with an internal review, and we develop a preliminary list that then we present for initial input. And then, and based on that, then we develop a draft list that we release to the public for comment to, you know, let us know if we should consider other projects or if we should consider different rankings for those projects that we've identified.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Lopez?
My question was, do we participate or do you participate with SAPA, the Santa Ana Water Quality Control Board?
Participate in the process?
Or information, well, sharing information or gathering information or in some way?
So we participate with SAPA as part of the public like noticing and public participation period. So they are part of the agencies that are allowed, that can comment on the draft list. But as far as partnering with developing the list, it's only as part of the public comment period.
But if I can add, so SAPA and its members have participated in the mm-hmm. scoping meetings. We do recognize each of the agencies that are part of SAPA, so they do comment on our approach, and they're involved with a lot of these projects as well as mm-hmm. as you, Uma. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. All we appreciate your time. And again, our thanks to all of the staff who are working on this effort. Thank you for your presentation. We'll now move on to item 12. And I'd like to ask Kyla Kawamura to come forward. Our water resources control engineer will present a status update on the environmental investigation and remediation at former Teflon recycling facility in the city of Santa Ana. Thank you.
Greetings, Chair Mori and dear board members. I'm Mona Burrus. I'm supervisor of the site cleanup program and also one of the previous case managers for the subject facility that we will be discussing today. Joining me today is one of my team members, Kayla Kawamura. She is currently the case manager for this site. We are presenting a status of environmental investigation and remediation at the former Teflon recycling facility in Santa Ana. Looks like that there is an error on this slide. The base map is not there. So the base map shows the area of Santa Ana and Irvine that is, for some reason, has disappeared from this slide. Those locations, the stars, are showing the location of the sites that are currently under the oversight of Santa Ana Water Board site cleanup program. All of these sites are industrial facilities that have discharged chemicals as a result of historical operations. It doesn't move the animation. Yes. So as a result of discharge at this facilities, a commingled plume has formed in Irvine and Santa Ana area. And I should also mention that there are also other sites that are located northwest of this area, and they are overseen by our sister agency, DTSC. Yeah, unfortunately, we have some technical problems. Looks like that the maps are not loading, but this is the footprint of the site. This trapezoidal shape is the footprint of this former recycling facility. The site is about 3.6 acres. And all the sites that I just mentioned that have created this regional plume in Irvine, Santa Ana area are in different stages of environmental investigation and remediation. This commingled plume that is created from different chemicals of concern has been called Orange County Water District South Basin Plume. So it's not the topic of this presentation, but we can certainly discuss it in future talks. So historical use and operation at this site included recycling of polytetrafluoroethylene, which is commonly known under the trademark Teflon. The area that you see on the map in that red rectangle is the processing area. Basically, the reactor that was used for processing of Teflon was located in that area. In earlier years, if you had visited the site, you would observe significant corrosion and deterioration of the surface at this site. Another example. Is there anything that we can do to show the map? Do we have a few minutes that we can switch to the other files that you have done? Because these are important information I would like to share with board members. Okay. As long as board members can see the photos. So significant corrosion and deterioration of the surface was observed if you had visited the site in earlier years of this project in early 2000. So now, let's talk about the process that was happening in old days at this site. So from 1972 to 1993, a scrap Teflon was shipped to the site and was subject to a process that basically recycled and cleaned the scrap Teflon. That mixture in that reactor that I just showed in the previous slide included 70% perchloric acid, 30% nitric acid at 300 degrees Celsius, and the mixture was there for 24 hours. So you can imagine that how corrosive and how oxidizing that mixture could have been. Then the Teflon pieces, after removal of all impurities, they were separated, they were neutralized, but as you can see in your slides in front of you, the discharge of those chemicals to the surface has been certainly very corrosive. You could see the staining and deterioration of the concrete at this site. But the process was supposed to include neutralization and then washing of those Teflon pieces and then letting them to dry. Then the clean Teflon or polytetrafluoroethylene was shipped back to the manufacturers or the facilities that are using it. So as a result of discharge of perchloric acid, that chemical was introduced to the subsurface. So what happened was that not only from the, you know, the crack area and the deterioration area, it found its way to the subsurface. So what happens when perchloric acid discharges to the subsurface? It dissociates. It's not stable. So it dissociates, it releases oxygen, and it creates... Next slide, please. It creates perchlorate. The molecule that you see on the top left is the molecule of perchlorate. It's highly oxidizing. It's a chlorine fully surrounded by oxygen. It's a strong oxidant. I should mention that perchlorate also exists in nature. It basically naturally can occur. But the topic of this presentation for today is the synthetic, the manufactured perchlorate that has been released to the subsurface at this site as a result of dissociation of the perchloric acid that was used for processing of Teflon. One of the important properties of perchlorate is that it's highly soluble. It's like table salt. It dissolves readily in water, and it can move with the same speed as groundwater in subsurface. What are some of the uses of perchlorate? As it was mentioned, and you can see in the depiction of the molecule of perchlorate, is a very strong oxidizing agent. It's used in solid rocket. And why is that? Because to propel a rocket, we need a very strong oxidant. So when perchlorate reacts with fuel, it generates enormous energy that is needed to overcome gravity and fire the rocket. So that's why perchlorate is used in rocket fuel and also in propellants. We have the California maximum contaminant level of 6 microgram per liter. Okay, perfect. Thank you. This is great. Or should we go back and see the previous slides?
Sure, if you want to illustrate the...
Absolutely, yeah.
And maybe just summarize just
yes.
For everyone's benefit.
So let's start from this slide. So again, this trapezoidal shape is, or one important slide is the slide showing our... the area of our all our sites. So the stars are the location of our sites under the oversight of the site cleanup program. There are several sites in the northwest of this study area. They are under oversight of our sister agency, DTSC. All of this site and the discharge from all of this site has formed that commingled plume that is called Orange County Water District South Basin Plume. The length of this plume is about 3 miles with a width of 1 mile. So you can imagine that a very large area of our basin has been impacted by historical industrial operation. So to quickly move to those indication of corrosion and percoric acid reaction with surface, you can see this staining as significant corrosion here. Okay, moving forward. So why should we care? What are some of the health impact of perchlorate? So perchlorate interferes with thyroid gland, and it causes issues with take-up of iodine. And because of that, it results in hormonal imbalance. In pregnant women, it causes developmental issues for the fetus. And also in children, exposure to water contaminated with perchlorate causes decrease in IQ. There are links with cancer, but they have not been proven yet. So with that, let's talk about the hydrologic setting at this site. So underneath the site and surrounding area, first we have a vadose zone, unsaturated zone, basically dry soil under the ground. Then we will reach to the first zone that is fully saturated with water. The formation in the first water bearing zone, what we call first water bearing zone, that first zone that is saturated with water, is dominantly fine grain, is clay formation. And then underneath that, there is another zone that is fully saturated with water, this time with a formation that is coarser grain. We call it second water bearing zone. So first water bearing zone at general vicinity of this site is approximately from 15 to 30 feet below ground surface. For the second water bearing zone is about 32 to 60 feet below ground surface. These intervals are subject of variation in different areas. We are talking about a sedimentary formation. So it's not like a layer cake. It just varies in thickness and in the interval that we encounter these water bearing zones. Just like the streams and rivers that we have, groundwater also has a dominant direction. So for the general area of the site, the predominant groundwater flow direction is towards south-southwest toward Pacific Ocean. So in this slide, you see the depiction of perchlorate concentrations in soil. As you noted in the first slide, there was significant corrosion and also cracks, all of which can act as preferential pathway to transport that perchloric acid and as a result of that, perchlorate to subsurface. So every dot that you see on this map is a location that the responsible party for this site has collected soil samples in different depth to characterize perchlorate in subsurface. As you can see in that heart of site, the former reactor area, the concentrations are highest in soil media. They are exceeding 100,000 microgram per kilogram. And then the area surrounding that, still very elevated concentrations. Even the areas that are not close to the former reactor area still show elevated concentration in various depth. So is that it? Is that all we have for the impact at this site? No, the impact has actually reached to the groundwater. Map on the right shows the depiction of perchlorate concentration within that first water bearing zone that was extending approximately from 15 to 30 feet below ground surface. I would like to have your attention that this is the depiction of the plume in 2024. From early years of this project, we worked with the responsible party and their consultants to install a groundwater extraction and containment system to prevent further migration of this plume to offsite areas so that we can prevent further degradation of the water quality downgradient. So this is how the plume looks like now, but Kayla will show us that how the plume looked like in old days. So this is the depiction in the first water bearing zone, elevated concentration, thousands of microgram per liter around the former reactor area. However, within the second water bearing zone, concentrations right now are non-detect. In fact, even from the earlier years, they were non-detect. And let's remember that the formation for the first water bearing zone is very tight, is clay formation. It just absorbs everything and holds it in place at the site. But does it mean that the plume has not migrated offsite? Let's see. So on top left of both maps, you see the depiction of the site, basically the site location. So map on the right, on the left, shows the first water bearing zone plume. And as you can see, the groundwater plume originating from the site, the perchlorate impacted groundwater plume, has migrated, in fact, thousands of feet down gradient of the source of release. Short of a mile has migrated down gradient. Map on the right shows the second water bearing zone plume. Again, it's very interesting that even though we did not see significant impact on site within the second water bearing zone, but from the footprint of this first water bearing zone, the plume has dove in and impacted the second water bearing zone, as you can see on the left, and it's migrating down gradient. So with that, let's take a look at some of the highlights and some of the regulatory considerations. So for any site that is under site cleanup program oversight, they are required to prepare a reasonably comprehensive conceptual site model, abbreviated as CSM. So what is a CSM? CSM is basically anything and everything that we know about a site. It includes the history of the site, the history of operation, the chemicals that were used, the areas of the site that was subject of the chemical release, lateral and vertical delineation of the extent of the impact in soil, in groundwater, depending on the type of chemical. In some of the sites that we have volatile chemicals, we also look at the soil vapor. But for this one, we are lucky that perchlorate is not volatile, so we are not looking at the vapor phase. And also the result of any pilot test, any full-scale remediation, it all goes to the conceptual site model to basically establish the story of the site. And that document is a living, breathing document that will be completed throughout the lifetime of the project. As it was mentioned, from the earlier years of this project, we worked with the responsible party and consultants to install an interim remediation, which was that pump and treat system to contain the plume on site until we figure out what to do for remediation of soil on site, first water bearing zone on site, and also groundwater off site for both first and second water bearing zone. With that, I will pass it to Kayla to tell us about the details of those remedial technologies.
Good afternoon, Chair Murray and members of the board. My name is Kayla Kawamura, and I'm a water resource control engineer in the site cleanup program and also the case manager for this project. And I will pick up from where Mona left off. So here we're looking at the perchlorate concentrations in groundwater on site. And you can see that in the early stages of the interim remediation, the perchlorate concentrations exceeded 100,000 micrograms per liter within the vicinity of the former source area. And then due to the source remediation and remediation at other high concentration areas, you can see that the perchlorate groundwater plume has reduced in size and in magnitude 20 years after the early stages of the interim remediation. So what was done to remediate the source area? The source area remediation focused on areas where the perchlorate concentrations exceeded 100,000 micrograms per kilogram. And this was done in 2019 using large diameter augers, two sizes, 5 foot diameter augers shown in the white circles, and 2.5 foot diameter augers shown in the red circles. And the excavation went down to as deep as 25 feet below ground surface. So let's take a look at these large diameter auger excavation and the boring completions. This figure shows the 5 foot diameter auger excavation that went down to around 25 feet below ground surface. And you can see that it was backfilled with slurry and the clean fill. The 2.5 foot auger was excavated 5 foot deeper into the saturated soil, followed by the slurry, or the wood desk was put between the wood chips and the slurry and the clean fill. The wood chips add an added benefit of stimulating in-situ bioremediation. What is bioremediation? It's the use of microbes to degrade contaminants. In this case, perchlorate degrading microbes are naturally present in the environment. And so when we add a carbon source like wood chips, that will stimulate the microbes to break down perchlorate into innocuous products. So these slides just show some photos taken during the field work of this excavation. The photo on the left shows the slurry being poured into the borehole. The photo on the middle is the drill rig that's used for the excavation. And the photo on the right are the wood chips being placed into the borehole. Something to note, 2 years following the remedial excavation, the perchlorate groundwater concentrations in groundwater reduced from as high as 23,000 micrograms per liter to 330 micrograms per liter. And this was in a well that was down gradient and near the source area. So we talked about what was done to take care of the source area. What about other high concentration areas at the site? So in 2020, in the pilot study area shown in the red square, there were direct push injections done to evaluate the distribution of a carbon source. In this case, it was emulsified vegetable oil to determine how effective this would be at reducing the perchlorate concentrations in soil and in groundwater. So on this slide, you can see the emulsified vegetable oil was injected into 10 points in the beta stone soil in the red circles. And then the EVO was also injected into the first water-bearing zone at the locations with the pink circles. Prior to doing the injections, there were pre-injection borings collected at incremental distances away from the injections, and that's indicated by the symbol with the purple stars. And those soil samples from those borings were analyzed for perchlorate to determine the pre-injection concentrations prior to the injections. And this would be compared to soil samples that were collected post-injection to compare how were the how effective the remediation was. So as I mentioned, post-injection soil samples were collected, and this was done at the same distances from the injections that the pre-injection soil samples were collected. I don't want to, I know there's a lot of text here and numbers on this slide. So if we just look at the table on the right, these are the pre-injection and goes from 30 days after the injection to 2 years following the injections. These are the perchlorate concentrations. Let's just look at the colors here. So the green colors indicate that perchlorate was not detected in these samples. And then the concentrations increase as you go from yellow to orange and to red with the highest. And let's just look at one of these as an example. So if you look at sample 6-2 at 15 feet below ground surface, the perchlorate concentrations were 16,000 micrograms per kilogram. And you can see that 30 days to 60 days following the injections, the concentrations were stable and maybe even increased a little bit. And this is due to the perchlorate washing through the soil. And then you can see that 60 days all the way to 2 years after the injections, the concentrations decreased. And this is due to the bioremediation of the perchlorate. And this slide here just provides another line of evidence that that bioremediation was occurring. So the top soil core that is shown is a pre-injection soil core that was taken, and the bottom two are soil cores that were collected 30 days and 60 days following the injections. And you can see in the pre-injection soil core the natural colors of the soil. And then you can see the gradual increase in the black discoloration of the soils in the 30-day and the 60-day cores. And this is indicates that there were favorable conditions for bioremediation to occur. So we talked about some of the remedial efforts that were conducted at the site. So what was done to address the off-site portion of the groundwater plume? Based on successes of a small-scale pilot study conducted in 2016, a V-shaped reactive zone was installed in from 2017 through 2018. And this reactive zone consists of 250 injection points. And it's about 1,200 feet long. And this is the largest reactive zone in our region and possibly in the state of California. And this slide here just shows a simple schematic of how these injections are done. So the EVO solution in this case is mixed to the desired concentration, and then it is pumped into the injection point to reach the target treatment zone. And then you have multiple injection points spaced about 5 feet apart, and this establishes a barrier for the contaminated groundwater to flow through. And then down gradient of our treatment barrier, we have monitoring wells to collect samples and to evaluate the performance of this remedy. Here are some photos of the field equipment that's used. So the photo on the left is the direct push rig platform, and that has mixing equipment. It has the EVO and the mixing equipment. It has the injection monitoring equipment. And then in the photo in the middle, that's just showing the pressure gauges and the flow meters. Those measure the pressure and the flow rate of the amendment being injected into the injection points. And then the photo on the right is the EVO solution being injected into one of the injection points, and the hose there connects to the injection point from the rig. So performance monitoring of this subsurface reactive zone, this is along Deer Avenue, is ongoing. And the data collected demonstrates that perchloric concentrations in excess of 100 micrograms per liter reduces to non-detect concentrations or less than 2 micrograms per liter as the groundwater flows through this reactive zone. This reactive zone was last replenished in June 2020, and based upon multiple lines of evidence, it was determined that additional replenishment of this reactive zone is necessary. So this month, we, under our general waste discharge requirements for in-situ remediation, we authorized the replenishment of this reactive zone in addition to installing an additional subsurface reactive zone approximately 500 feet up gradient. And this next reactive zone will be approximately 110 injection points and 550 feet long. And given that the length of this offsite perchlorate plume is 4,300 feet, installing additional reactive barriers at different sections of the plume will significantly reduce the time to reach remedial goals and to clean up the plume. So in summary, while the investigation at the and the remediation at the site is still ongoing, these remedial efforts just highlight how the collaborative effort between the Water Board and the responsible party and their consultant have resulted in building a comprehensive conceptual site model and implementation of effective remedies at the site to protect groundwater resources. So that concludes our presentation. We just want to thank you for your attention and the opportunity to share these positive results. We'd like to acknowledge site cleanup case managers who have previously worked on this case, the responsible party for their cooperation, and the consulting team for their good work on this project, and the local agencies who have also helped move this project along with the permitting. Thank you, and we'll take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Kayla and Mona. With that, I'll open it up to the board for comments and questions. Anyone? Oh. Board
Just
member
thank
Alvarado.
You. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for all the information and for actually, this is such a great, successful partnership, and I think we need to highlight it even more. Yeah. It took a lot of years and a lot of work, but this is yet a great example that we can, you know, emulate everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, I would just, Vice Chair Scandura, please.
Sure. And again, thank you both Kayla and Mona for the outstanding presentation. Of course, I have a bias towards this stuff because I spent so many years of my career on these types of sites. And by the way, that dry cleaner that was among our consent calendar items, that was actually one of the sites in my branch when I was a DTSC many years ago. So I'm glad to see work's being done on that one. Certainly, a presentation like this shows just how bad some of these facilities are. I mean, it's, you go in there that bad. I'm sure if you stuck your finger in there, you'd come out with a bone. I mean, you literally eat through your flesh. We also saw how the solution just cut through concrete like butter. So it's, and it was obvious to me, at least, very sloppy housekeeping keeping practices on the part of the owner-operator. One interesting question, who was the actual responsible party that you worked with? Was it the actual operator or was it a landowner?
It was, they had owned the site at one time and they also operated at the site.
Okay, and so they did cooperate. That's really good. I noticed the remediation was primarily bioremediation and permeable reactive barrier. Was there any pump and treat that was employed in this?
Yes, as I think Mona showed it in her slides, or she had mentioned it, but there is a groundwater extraction system that's operating, and there are some extraction wells at the site, and that's basically containing the perchloric plume and keeping it on site and not letting it migrate further off site.
I see, and then it injects it back, injects the treated water back into the aquifer right there.
It's treated with anion exchange, and then it's discharged to the sewer under a permit with the sanitation district.
Sure. And then I noticed when you showed the picture of the injection wells and what have you, it looked like it was in a shopping center. Was that correct, or is that where you had the trucks and what have you?
You have a good eye. That was actually a photo from another site that I went to, but I wanted to use the photo of the platform that is still also used at this site that we're talking about.
Okay, because that just, if it wasn't a shopping center, that just adds another layer of logistics, working with the property owners and the like. And then last of all, because Teflon tends to be associated with PFOAs and PFOSs, are there going to be any plans to actually require investigations or do investigations on that?
Great question. So back in 2016, years before a state board starts the phase approach for PFAS investigation in several facilities, including landfills, airports, chromium plating facilities, we asked this responsible party to analyze for PFAS. Back in 2016, there were only limited labs that were testing, and they were only testing for those two PFAS compounds, PFOA and PFOS, that have been subject to the highest regulatory scrutiny. So we do have numbers for PFOA and PFOS. The highest detection for at the site are related to PFOS, surprisingly. The reason I'm saying surprisingly is that, in fact, PFOA is the chemical that has been utilized as surfactant in manufacturing of PTFE. But the well closest to the reactor area has shown concentration as high as 1,880 parts per trillion. Just to refresh your memory, the MCL currently for PFOA and PFOS is 4 parts per trillion. So there was detection of exceeding 1,800 parts per trillion for PFOS. For PFOA, the concentrations were detected much lower, in about 170 parts per trillion range. So the results are not conclusive. And the reason is that, similar to the facilities, board members, that we have asked them for the first time for sampling of PFAS, we requested the sampling for this site to check for the presence of PFAS. We haven't started requesting our sites for delineation of PFAS. So the answer of the question, if PFAS has been detected at this facility, is yes. For PFOA, 170 parts per trillion, PFOS, 1,880 parts per trillion. The wells at the property boundary down gradient, they came back in about 10 parts per trillion. However, we don't know what is the background concentration. As you notice, there is a large commingled plume, and the area is highly industrialized. And as you know, because of the widespread use of PFAS, it's highly likely that other sites also had PFAS release. So our next step would be to ask, based on the history of the site, for the sites that have potential for release of PFAS, all the sites, including the sites that are upgradient of this particular case, to analyze for PFAS. And now, years after 2016, we do have analytical method that can detect additional compounds within PFAS family. So it's well documented that PTFE processing, especially under harsh condition that you observed in 300 degrees C for 24 hours in strong acidic environment, can release PFAS chemicals. But we need to do further investigation to see that what are those chemicals potentially.
Okay, so the responsible party can't quite go away yet. They need to come back and investigate for PFAS and PFOA. But the 1,800 part per trillion detection, it may not necessarily mean that it came from that facility.
That is true. We don't have any data to show that what is the concentration in their upgradient area.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Board Member Lopez.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, both of you. It's a very comprehensive update. I've read about this project somewhere in the past, but thank you very much. My question is, when you go out to the public, do you present this or do you refine it a little bit?
So for this part,
because it's very a lot of technicality in this, if you go out in the public, they go, huh? What's she talking about?
That is a great question. For this particular case, we haven't had public meeting. And the reason is that we look at the risk when we consider public meetings. So perchlorate is not a chemical that is volatile. And there are not any residential community around it. The area is highly industrialized. There is no drinking water well that has been impacted necessarily by this chemical. So we haven't had, although all our information are public, they are published in our GeoTracker website, and we have also issued historically fact sheets informing public about the case, but we haven't had public meetings. However, in all the public meetings that we hold for our other sites, we have held public meetings for several sites that involve vapor intrusion. For those type of meetings, absolutely, we use non-technical language. We modify technical information, we rehearse, and we make sure that public can relate, can understand all this technical information in simple language.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to echo the comments of my colleagues that this was an extraordinary achievement. It obviously took a lot of stakeholders and collaborative partners working together, as led by our staff, which we're so appreciative of. Hopefully it's created some best practices, not just for our region, but for the state and potentially nation on how to deal with some of these concentrated impacts from industrialized use that, you know, just weren't realized at the time, but now have potentially generational health impacts. So we're also appreciative of the work you've done, and thank you for being so thorough. I was doing my best as a non-scientist to really follow all of those, you know, the before and afters and the in-betweens, the markers in between. So thank you. It was very thorough, and we appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman.
All right, we'll move on to item 13. That was a discussion item, so we have nothing to vote on at this time, but I will move to item 13 and ask Jane to present her executive officer's report.
So very, very quickly, the executive officer's report has a couple of updates. One's on the former aeronautics site in Newport, the Bay Burn Tuition site that we typically have updates for. Just as note, there is another public meeting on August 28th. And then we also provide an update on our underground storage tank cleanup process. And that's all I have. So very simple.
Thank you. All right. And then item 14, board member and executive officer of communications. I'll go down to my right, and we'll move this way. If anyone has any questions, comments, or final remarks for our meeting today.
No, I'd just like to say that we had a update, you know, on the MS4. Was it Tuesday or Wednesday, you know, with staff, and I really appreciate that update. It gave me a little better understanding of what the whole project is about. So, and I wanted to thank staff and for allowing me to participate in that. Thank you.
I will echo that, my gratitude for all the training and all the additional information. And again, saying thank you for the presentations. This is great, and I know that the public appreciates to see that we are working together to maintain a quality of water for everyone. I'm gonna use a point of privilege to say that as part of the outreach and in inclusion, I have invited the UCI Labor Center interns that are working with the organization that I am employed with, the Orange County Labor Federation. And if I could have them please stand. These are young, enthusiastic, involved individuals that, yes, definitely.
Go Anteaters.
And they are residents of local cities. And I know that this was probably something that they will utilize to continue being engaged and involved. Thank you so much for all the work that our staff do. And once again, thank you for the privilege to allow me to introduce them.
Real quick, Board Member Lopez asked me to
return. That's like a photo opportunity, isn't it?
Yeah.
For them to come up there and, you know, take
maybe
photos.
We just finish the meeting and then we'll have them come up and do a photo with all of us. That'd be lovely. Okay. Board Member Clark.
Well, I just want to thank Director Alvarado, you're walking the walk, not just talking the talk. I appreciate that. It's in line with everything we were talking about today. The youth is our future. Even the last presentation where you all articulated that you're intentional about, you know, breaking the information down so that it is palatable to our community, which I just think is really important. That intentionality is a big step in changing culture overall. So just appreciate hearing that. Just thankful for all the presentations, but I'll take a point of privilege in just saying that I truly enjoy serving on this board. We're so collegial, and upon election season, you know, we can see things get pretty tense, you know, out there in the community. So it's just a pleasure to be able to serve on a board where we all work so well together and are just carrying out the democratic process in a peaceful and kind way. So thank you.
Board Member Rue.
Just thank you, everybody, for the hard work you've put into the great presentations today and putting it in language that I, a layman, can understand. And also, and I hope I'm not taking away somebody's thunder, I believe we have a congratulations to Director Alvarado for being named one of the 20 most influential people in Orange County.
Okay, and first of all, it's great to have us all back together again. Somehow I feel when we miss a meeting, I feel like I get disengaged from being with the Water Board, so it's great to be back here again. Thank you again to the staff for the MS4 permit briefing to all of us. This is such a complex and mammoth project, and so we really appreciate all your efforts to help bring us up to speed. Wow, UCI labor interns, UCI labor interns. Welcome to our meeting. I am a UCI graduate. The only thing is I graduated sometime back in the 1800s. So anyway. For me this month, for our families, a rather busy month. We have two special ladies that are celebrating milestones. My mother, last week on Wednesday the 17th, turned 90 years old. But then my mother-in-law, not to be outdone by my mother-in-law, on this coming Sunday, she turns 100. So we're all celebrating. In fact, this afternoon, her bank, Farmers and Merchants in Long Beach, is going to be throwing a birthday party. So just so you know, if you bank at Farmers and Merchants and turn 100, they'll throw a birthday party. I don't belong to Farmers and Merchants, and I don't know if I'm going to turn 100. So anyway, thank you for today's meeting.
Well, congratulations to both of those amazing women. You definitely have good genes in your family. I just want to thank my colleagues and our staff. We really are incredibly blessed to have such a great working relationship, have such an extraordinarily dedicated team of individuals and the expertise that you all have, but also the incredible passion that you bring to this agency and to the people we serve. So thank you for that. Thank you to our IT staff for being so nimble and patient and calm under pressure today. We definitely had our challenges, but IT is ultimately our friend. And also to the City of Orange for hosting us today. Thank you for opening your chamber to the community who is with us in person, also to everyone online. Thank you for joining us. I just want to wish everyone a wonderful, safe weekend, and we will see you again at our next meeting, which is September 13th. And with that, we will have a quick photo shoot, too, after this meeting. But God bless you all, and have a wonderful day.